Last Wednesday, Hezbollah crossed the UN blue line in southern Lebanon, killed 3 Israeli soldiers, captured 2 others, and demanded the release of Lebanese prisoners in Israeli jails. Hezbollah's attack broke the UN rules in southern Lebanon. Geir Pedersen, the senior UN official in Lebanon, called it a violent breach of the blue line. It provided the occasion for Israel to open up a second front in Lebanon, parallel to the similar operation that has been delivering air and artillery strikes for the last couple of weeks in Gaza. Writing from his home in Beirut, Robert Fisk describes how he could hear the jets all night long, quote, whispering high above the Mediterranean. It lasted for hours, he says, little fireflies that were watching Beirut, waiting for dawn, perhaps, because it was then that they descended. He writes that they came first to the little village of Dwer near Nabatea in southern Lebanon, where an Israeli plane dropped a bomb onto a home of a Shia Muslim cleric. He was killed. So was his wife. So were 8 of his children. Also writing from Beirut, The Guardian's longtime correspondent David Hurst lamented that Lebanon had been plunged back into the role it endured for a quarter century and more, that of hapless arena for other people's wars, as well as pawn in the ambitions and machinations of regional players far more powerful than itself. From Jerusalem, Haaretz correspondent Zvi Barel didn't see it that way. He accused Lebanese commentators of being far from attributing to any Lebanese government the ability to disarm Hezbollah or to deploy its forces along the southern border. Therefore, he concludes that all eyes are turned to the secret talks between Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon, and less so to the Security Council deliberations. Rami Khoury, a regular contributor to Beirut's English-language Daily Star, wasn't ready to let the U.S. off the hook so easily. Quote, "You need to understand the relationship among 4 pairs of actors to grasp the meaning of the escalating attacks by Hamas and Hezbollah and Israel," he says. The 4 pairs are Hamas and Hezbollah, the Palestinian and Lebanese governments, Syria and Iran, Israel and the United States. Simplistically, U.S. President George W. Bush has depicted this latest round of war as a clash between good and evil, while the Israeli government has tried to blame Palestinians and Lebanese, who only want to make war, against a peace-loving Israel. The more nuanced and complex reality is that all the actors in the 4 pairs collectively play a role in the ongoing fighting, as we witness the culmination of 4 decades of failed policies that have kept the Middle East tense, angry, and violent. End quote. On his way to the G8 meeting in St. Petersburg, Prime Minister Stephen Harper told reporters, quote, "I think Israel's response under the circumstances has been measured," end quote. From the reports we get here, you would never guess how little agreement there is about the details. Fisk speculates that prisoner swaps is probably all that will come of this and points out that such exchanges between Israel and Lebanon have a long history. Fisk concludes that the Lebanese and Israelis know how this cruel game is played. How many have to die before the swaps begin is a more important question. Peace activist and former left-wing member of Knesset Uri Avneri insists that the real aim is to change the regime in Lebanon and to install a puppet government. That was the aim of Ariel Sharon's invasion of Lebanon in 1982, he says. It failed. But Sharon and his pupils in the military and political leadership have never really given up on it. As in 1982, the present operation, too, was planned and is being carried out in full coordination with the U.S. As then, there is no doubt that it is coordinated with a part of the Lebanese elite. That's the main thing. Everything else is noise and propaganda. End quote. On the other front, in Gaza, the idea that whatever the fate of the captive soldier Gilad Shalit may be, the Israeli army's war in Gaza is not about him, was confirmed by security analyst Alex Fishman, writing in Yediat Aharonot. Fishman, who favors the elimination of Hamas, says that the army was preparing for an attack months earlier and was constantly pushing for it, with the goal of destroying the Hamas infrastructure and its government. The abduction of the soldier released the safety catch, and the operation began on the 28th of June with the destruction of infrastructure in Gaza and the mass detention of the Hamas leadership in the West Bank, which was also planned weeks in advance. Ismail Haniyeh expressed much the same idea a week later in an article for the Washington Post. Corporal Shalit, he said, is only a pretext for a job scheduled months ago. Karen Kwiatkowski, a retired U.S. Air Force lieutenant colonel, recalls the strategic vision in a paper written for Benjamin Netanyahu by Richard Perle and a number of influential American neoconservatives. She argues that that paper, called A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, is the key to understanding Israel's current security policy. Back in Beirut, Fisk points out that in past violence of this kind, Syria's power was controlled by Hafez Assad, one of the shrewdest Arabs in modern history. But there are those, including Lebanese politicians, who believe that Bashar, the son, lacks his late father's wisdom and understanding of power. Similar questions have been raised about Ehud Olmert. Writing in the conservative Jerusalem Post, David Horowitz says, many outside commentators have loudly wondered over the weekend whether a government led by military veterans such as Ariel Sharon or Yitzhak Rabin would have responded to Hezbollah's cross-border onslaught last Wednesday in the way that Ehud Olmert and Amir Peretz have. The answer, he concludes, is almost certainly yes. A more challenging question, according to Horowitz, is whether Nasrallah would have dared authorize the attack had a Sharon or Rabin been in power. Israeli PM Ehud Olmert is not well known outside Israel. At 60, he is a lifelong politician who was first elected to the Knesset at 28. He officially became prime minister in April, but had been the acting PM since January when his mentor, Ariel Sharon, suffered a massive stroke and was incapacitated. Even those who hated Ariel Sharon recognized him as a rare individual, especially so when compared to others in that small group of generals who try their hand at politics. He was a far better general than, say, Colin Powell, brilliant, idiosyncratic, equivocal, brutal, and he was a successful politician. One thinks of Eisenhower, de Gaulle. He got away with frequent acts of insubordination and deceit against his superiors. Although he was forced to resign as defense minister after the inquiry into Sabra and Shatila, he was still the individual who made facts on the ground a household phrase. On the other hand, Ehud Olmert is a municipal politician who inherited the master's most ambitious endgame. His military training, especially when compared with almost every other Israeli leader, has been brief. He was injured during his compulsory military service and released early. He completed his military duties as a journalist for the Armed Forces magazine and was a military correspondent during the Yom Kippur War in 1973. However, speaking of Israel's other prime ministers, Time magazine describes Olmert as probably the best politician of them all. A lawyer, a dealmaker, and an inside man, he is a former finance minister and minister of trade and development. He spent two terms as mayor of Jerusalem, concentrating on development and transit issues. As mayor of Jerusalem between 1993 and 2003, he advocated expanding settlements in the West Bank surrounding the city. His Israel is a modern democratic society, not a biblical reenactment. He calculated that Israel couldn't rule the Palestinians in Gaza and remain a democracy. In November 2003, he gave a speech foreshadowing Sharon's disengagement plan. Soon after, he gave his views in an interview. Quote, "We are approaching the point where more and more Palestinians will say, we have been won over. We agree with Lieberman. There is no room for two states between the Jordan River and the sea. All we want is the right to vote. The day they do that is the day we will lose everything," Olmert said. "Even when they carry out terror, it is very difficult for us to persuade the world of the justice of our cause. We see this on a daily basis. all the more so when there is only one demand, an equal right to vote. The thought that the struggle against us will be headed by liberal Jewish organizations who shouldered the burden of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa scares me, end quote. Israeli PM Ehud Olmert speaking in 2003. Olmert lacks the military experience to get away with floating like a butterfly, so we probably will see a lot of stinging like a bee. That can have a devastating effect on the home folks, especially if the war isn't over quickly. Israeli actions in Gaza and Lebanon seem to be similarly designed. In both cases, air and artillery attacks were first unleashed to cut transportation routes and cordon off key areas. The army is now moving in to tighten the noose. In fact, these are textbook invasions. The generals are in charge. The most obvious problem with this kind of maneuver is the civilians killed in bombardments or cut off from supplies like water and food. Olmert may be politically savvy enough not to dismiss civilian deaths as collateral damage, but to understand them as a terminal liability in fighting fourth-generation war. That's it for this Monday. This edition of World Report has been archived on the World Report website at cjly.net/worldreport. You can get it either as a podcast or in raw MP3 format. There is also a link to a text version of the broadcast. To comment or suggest a story, send email to earthling@cjoy.net or by snail mail to Box 767, Nelson, British Columbia, Canada, V1L5R4. I'm Jim Terrell at Kootenai Co-op Radio. Thanks for listening.